All right, you faithful ones, we're going to get started because it is 11:15.
I told you to start right on
time. I do.
You rushed in.
I do.
I love that.
Yeah. No, it's fine. Other people will probably wander in. There's probably lots of donuts and fun things out there. I teach at Western Seminary. I teach world religions.
Okay.
I've been doing that for about 20 years. So usually my seminars are world religion related, but this one just has been a big thing for me. I think since our son's friend left the faith, I'm like, okay, we gotta do something here.
Yeah.
So it's very personal. So when we last left yesterday, I was telling you about this book for teens, called This Changes Everything, How the Gospel Transformed the Teen Years, a great small group thing. Again, she talks to teenagers, and you can even go online, and she has a great promo for this book. So let me just play that for you.
Let me ask you a question. Has the gospel changed your life? Sure, you can say you believe there's a God, or you were raised in a Christian family, or you're involved in church activities. But has the gospel really changed you? Because that's what makes Jesus different. If he's really entered your life, it will be transformed to the core. If the gospel is true, it will change the things you believe, think, say, and do. It will change your goals and what you treasure, the way you look at yourself and the way you relate to others, the way you invest your time and passion, even what you do for entertainment. Truth is, our lives can't remain the same from the moment Jesus is in us. We become part of a countercultural movement that defies the status quo, stereotypes, and the culture of self. Regardless of our age or experience, we become part of it. We become part of a kingdom and a story and an adventure that changes absolutely everything. So has the gospel changed your life?
So I love that because it's promoting this very central idea that the gospel actually does change your life. It's not just something you kind of tack on and you go about daily life as you always have. It's something very transformative. And I think that can be very appealing to young people. So our point was that we had left off on was keeping the gospel at the center of faith and of life. There are a lot of peripheral issues that end up getting a lot of our attention. And I think that sometimes kids can get this mixed message that those things are what's essential rather than the gospel being essential. So keeping that center. And by doing that, if there are fundamental questions, like questions about Genesis 1, that kids aren't, you know, maybe they come to a different conclusion than you've come to, they don't have to leave the faith because they look at Genesis 1 differently than maybe you have traditionally, if you keep the gospel at the center of faith and of life. Point three is to bring young people into the full life of the church. And there's another book written by Kara Powell. This one just came out, and I haven't read the whole thing. But if you're involved in your church, this might be a good one to pick up. Six Essential Strategies to Help Young People Discover and Love Your Church. It's a book called Growing Young. And of course, they're very aware of the fact that young people are very unchurched. Even young people that grow up in the church, they aren't usually involved. And one of the things they talk about is how to get people, young people involved in the church at a younger age. Not just going to youth group or going on youth group mission trips, but how do we connect them to the full life of the church and value them? One of the things they say is that they have found in their research that if a child in your church is connected, really connected to five adults that aren't like, you know, Aunt Janine or somebody, but they are unrelated adults of different age groups, if they know those people and those people know them, that they not just say hi on Sunday morning, but they ask, how did your test go? I was praying for you. How was the soccer match? They actually know things about their lives. those are crucial connections in keeping kids in church. Because what happens is, it's like when I was a kid and we were having company over, the kids would sit at the kids' table, right? You probably did that in your family. And we loved it when we were kids because we could do all kinds of things at the kids' table that normally I couldn't do at the dinner table, you know? So we thought it was great. The adults thought it was great because they could have conversation and not be interrupted by the kids. But eventually, at some point in your growing up years, when you're a teenager, you're like, I don't want to sit at the kids' table anymore. You want to be seen, even though you're not yet an adult. You want adults around you to start looking at you more like an adult, even though you're still growing. And that happens in the church as well. I think we sometimes keep our kids at the kids' table too long. We keep them in youth group, like that's good enough for you. You do the youth group mission trip or whatever. And then we say, go away to college, and then when you come back, then we're going to integrate you into the church. Will they come back? That's always a big question. So how do we get kids connected to the full church in a vital way? Just a simple thing I happened to notice at our church just a few weeks ago, we were having communion, and I noticed that all the communion servers were like my age and older. Now, any 13-year-old could serve communion. And it's not about the service. Service is important, and teaching our kids to serve is important, but they're getting that message in the public school as well. That's a really big thing, serving your community. And that's not, you know, the essential gospel message. Obviously, serving is a part of it, and serving is important, but that's not why you would want them to serve communion. It's because now if you've got a 13-year-old in there with the 50-year-old and the 35-year-old, and they're part, every month, they're part of that team that serves, they're starting to get to know these other people in the church in an actual relationship. So just ways like that we can start bringing these young people into the life of the church. I mean, some churches, one of the best ways is through music. You know, you get your young people who can play the guitar or the drums or whatever on the music team, and that allows the worship pastor to actually build into their lives and get to know them. So there's different ways this can be done, and they have a lot of good ideas in this book. But bringing them into the full life of the church at an earlier stage, rather than saying you have to wait till you're 25 to actually do something in big church, so to speak. And also, I think it's really important to take advantage of all the resources to help young people through their doubts and questions. And this is what I want to spend most of my time on today, is looking at some of these resources. Now, two of my favorite resources that I'd like to promote, Timothy Keller. How many of you have heard of Timothy Keller? Okay, he's a wonderful pastor in Manhattan, just retired from day-to-day pastoring, but is still writing and speaking. And what I love about him, he spent all this time in Manhattan, so he knows about the way secular people think and the kinds of questions secular, intellectual, educated people have. So he's written his books really for that audience. And the first one he wrote, Reasons for God, Belief in an Age of Skepticism, it's really a two-part book where he first addresses very typical objections or questions that people have about the Christian faith. So chapter one, there can't just be one true religion. He addresses that question. How could a good God allow suffering? Isn't Christianity a straitjacket? The church is responsible for so much injustice. Have you ever heard that kind of objection? Science has disproved Christianity. You can't take the Bible literally. So he kind of goes through those top questions. And then the second part, he lays out reasons for faith to show that faith is not just blind, it's not just emotional or traditional, but that there's actual good reasons for our faith. And he lays those out in the second half of the book. So this is a great book. Really would recommend that to you. And then the other one he just came out with is called Making Sense of God, An Invitation to the Skeptical. Now, this is different in that he said, he realized that he needed to go back even further with secular people than just kind of answering questions about their Christian faith. He said most people aren't even there yet to where they are asking questions. Most people are further back. And what I love about this book, I don't know how the man finds the time to read that he does and what all the things he's read. It's just amazing. But he has done all that hard work for you, and he fishes out all these gems, these quotes from playwrights and philosophers and ancient Christians and modern Christians and ancient philosophers. I mean, it's all in here, from Aristotle to Dawkins, you know. And he's looked at all this stuff, and he's compiled so much good stuff. But what he does is he takes the quest that we all have for meaning. Remember we talked about that, for meaning, for satisfaction, for freedom, for identity and hope, and all those kind of human things we have. Secularism realizes that we have this, but it has a secular narrative to provide that for people who aren't going to believe in God. And so what he does is he takes each one of those things, for instance, the quest for meaning, and he shows how secularism tries to say, yes, people can still have meaning without God. He shows how that fails, and then he shows how what Christianity brings actually answers the question in a more profound and satisfying way than secularism. So he just, the other thing he does, I wish I had a whiteboard, but there's a great philosopher by the name of Charles Taylor who wrote a book called The Secular Age. And I understood that he is so deep that most people can't read it and understand what he's saying. So I actually read a book that's like Charles Taylor for Dummies. And that book was really hard for me to get through. And what he has done is done Charles Taylor for Dummies for Dummies. He's such a good simplifier. So what he has done is he's taken this, what Charles Taylor points out is that secularism tells the story that what secularism is when you just subtract out things like superstition and, you know, faith in a God, which now we know that we don't need. What is left is secularism. It's just sort of obviously true to everyone. And what Charles Taylor points out, and apparently magnificently works through philosophically, is that actually secularism is also very much a faith position. There are many, many things you have to take on faith. Secular people don't think that they're taking anything on faith. They think they're just dealing with facts and reason and so forth. And he shows that that's actually not the case, that there's many, many things that you're really just replacing one worldview that you take by faith with another worldview that you have to take by faith. And there's reasons for both of those worldviews, but secular people don't realize that they're taking so much on faith. So he does just a great job. And what I want to really challenge you, now some of you I know, you're like, I just can't read that kind of stuff. If I start to read that stuff, I fall asleep in 5 minutes. It just makes my head spin. I can't read it. Fine. But some of you can. And frankly, we need more people, and I'm going to harp here, we need more people in our churches who are willing to give up binge watching the greatest baking British show or whatever, British baking show or some other thing, and take some time to read and just to start critically thinking. And these guys have done so much of the hard work for you. God bless Tim Keller. He's done so much of the hard work for you that if you read this, if you take the time to slowly go through it and understand what he's arguing, you're going to have amazing tools for conversations with your own kids, with neighbor kids, with friends, with family. It's amazing. It's wonderful stuff. So if you're like, yeah, I could read something like that, then please do. Please, I'm begging you, take the time to read some of this stuff. It's really good. So I just can't recommend those enough. They are in the bookstore. Pick it up, read it. Yeah. You know, I would start with this one first, because this is the one he said, I should have written this one first. He thought people were kind of here. He realized people are actually way back here. So he starts at a more fundamental level with this book. So I would start with this one, and then this one is getting into more the specifics of Christianity. I mean, he brings that all out in this book as well, because he's going to show that an identity in Christ is where true identity can be found versus what our culture is telling us how to find identity. I mean, he does all of that in this book, but then this book is more specifically answering objections to the Christian faith. So those are both good. And there's other books that are good. I just think he does just a real masterful job. He's one of our best resources. Now, maybe part of the trouble with our kids, we talked about them not having a robust faith. And frankly, a lot of kids are getting Sunday school stories. You know, they know David and Goliath and Noah's Ark or whatever. They get stories, but they're not maybe really understanding what the Bible is all about. They might come out of high school and they go, yeah, I know some stories. Yeah, I know John 3:16. I know the basic story of Jesus. But there's a lot in the Bible I just don't get. I don't know why it's in there. I don't know what it's about. There's a really amazing man who's doing great work on this issue. His name is Tim Mackey. And he has a website called thebibleproject.org. Because what he said he found, especially with the millennials, is that they were the ones even that were retaining their faith were really becoming a post-Bible Christian. That there was a Christianity that they had that had kind of been taught, they'd heard it in church, they were clinging to it, but they really didn't know how to go to the Bible and support it. They didn't know how to wrestle with what the Bible is teaching. They weren't really reading their Bibles because it didn't really make sense to them. And so his whole focus is on making the Bible come alive again in a way that's very accessible to the younger generation, that everything is media and everything's driven in that way. He actually got a guy, because Tim is a very good artist, but he needed somebody who was really, really good. Because I've seen Tim in person. He'll tell the story of, you know, a big theme in the Bible, and he draws it all out on a whiteboard. It's amazing. But he got a guy who was doing those kind of videos for the Silicon Valley. Like if some company wanted to be able to explain some device that they had, he would do videos that had animation and all that sort of thing. So Tim gets this guy, and this guy also admitted that he was a post-Bible Christian. He was a Christian, but just didn't really know much about the Bible. And the two of them have teamed up to do the Bible Project. They have already done every single book of the Bible. I binge-watched these one day because they're only like 7 minutes long, 5 to 7 minutes. And what he wants to do is, it's not, yes, there are many, many more details in these books than he can get to in a 7-minute video, but his big purpose is to keep showing the overarching story that the Bible is telling, one big story of God's good creation, of the fall of man, God's rescue plan, and how that works out in Jesus Christ. That story runs all the way through the Bible, and he wants to show in every book how that is present, how grace is present, God's plan is present in every book. And then he's also done lots of videos where he just goes through one big theme that is present over and over again in the Bible, like, for instance, the day of the Lord, or the image of God, things like that. So I want to show you, maybe we do have time to show you the first part of the book of Genesis. So he divided Genesis into two halves, and this is the first part. Yes.
Can I recommend something else?
Please? Sure. Uh-huh. Yeah, absolutely.
There's a children's Bible. It's called the Jesus Storybook Bible. Every story whispers his name.
It's awesome. I should have put that on the sheet. I don't know why I didn't. I was thinking more teenagers, but that for you. It's really good. They probably have that one over in the bookstore too. Yeah, someone gave it to me for my little grandson, Freddie, and I can't wait when he's old enough to start that. Because again, it's this idea that Jesus is actually on every page of the Bible. And on the road to Emmaus, that's exactly what Jesus did, is he opened the eyes of these disciples to say, actually, what Moses wrote about, what the prophets wrote about, what even David wrote about in the Psalms was all pointing to me. And so I love that the Jesus storybook Bible does the same thing. So I really highly recommend that for your kids. So let me play just a little bit of this book of Genesis.
The book of Genesis. It's the first book of the Bible, and its storyline divides into two main parts. There's chapters 1 through 11, which tell the story of God and the whole world, and then there's chapters 12 through 50, which zoom in and tell the story of God and just one man, Abraham, and then his family. And these two parts are connected by a hinge story at the beginning of chapter 12. And this design, it gives us a clue to how to understand the message of the book as a whole and how it introduces the story of the whole Bible. So the book begins with God taking the disorder and the darkness described in the second sentence of the Bible, and God brings out of it order and beauty and goodness. He makes a world where life can flourish. And God makes these creatures called humans, or Adam in Hebrew. He makes them in his image, which has to do with their role and purpose in God's world. So the humans are made to be reflections of God's character out into the world, and they're appointed as God's representatives to rule his world on his behalf, which in context means to harness all of its potential, to care for it, and make it a place where even more life can flourish. God blesses the humans. It's a key word in this book. And he gives them a garden. It's like a place from which they begin starting to build this new world. Now, the key is that the humans have a choice about how they're going to go about building this world. And that's represented by the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. Up till now, God has provided and defined what is good and what is not good. But now God is giving the humans the dignity and the freedom of a choice. Are they going to trust God's definition of good and evil, or are they going to seize autonomy and define good and evil for themselves? And the stakes are really high. To rebel against God is to embrace death, because you're turning away from the giver of life himself. This is represented by the tree of life. And so in chapter 3, a mysterious figure, a snake, enters into the story. The snake's given no introduction other than it's a creature that God made. And it becomes clear that it's a creature in rebellion against God, and it wants to lead the humans into rebellion and their death. The snake tells a different story about the tree and the choice. It says that seizing the knowledge of good and evil are not going to bring death, that it's actually the way to life and becoming like God themselves. Now, the irony of this is tragic, because we know the humans, they're already like God. They were made to reflect God's image. But instead of trusting God, the humans seize autonomy. They take the knowledge of good and evil for themselves, and in an instant, the whole story spirals out of control. The first casualty is human relationships. The man and the woman, they suddenly realize how vulnerable they are now. They can't even trust each other. And so they make clothes and they hide their bodies from one another. The second casualty is that intimacy between God and the humans is lost. So they go and run and hide from God. And then when God finds them, they start this game of blame shifting about who rebelled first. Now, right here, the story stops, and there's a series of short poems where God declares to the snake and then to the humans the tragic consequences of their actions. God first tells the snake that despite its apparent victory, it is destined for defeat, to eat dust. God promises that one day a seed or a descendant will come from the woman who's going to deliver a lethal strike to the snake's head. Which sounds like great news, but this victory is going to come with a cost, because the snake, too, will deliver a lethal strike to the descendant's heel as it's being crushed. It's a very mysterious promise of this wounded victor. But in the flow of the story so far, you see this is an act of God's grace. The humans, they've just rebelled, and what does God do? He promises to rescue them. But this doesn't erase the consequences of the human's decision. So God informs them that now every aspect of their life together, at home and out in the field, it's going to be fraught with grief and pain because of the rebellion, all leading to their death. From here, the story then spirals downward. Chapters 3 through 11, they trace the widening ripple effect of the rebellion and of human relationships fracturing at every level. So there's a story about two brothers, Cain and Abel. Cain's so jealous of his brother that he wants to murder him. And God warns him not to give in to the temptation, but he does anyway. He murders him in the field. So Cain then goes on to build a city where violence and oppression reign. And this is all epitomized in the story of Lamech. He's the first man in the Bible to have more than one wife. He's accumulating them like property. And then he goes on to sing a short song about how he's more violent and vengeful than Cain ever was. After this, we get an odd story about the sons of God, which could refer to evil angelic beings, or it could refer to ancient kings who claimed that they descended from the gods. And like Lamech, they acquire as many wives as they wanted, and they produce the Nephilim, these great warriors of old. Whichever view is right, the point is that humans are building kingdoms that fill God's world with violence and even more corruption. In response, we're told that God is broken with grief. Humanity is ruining his good world, and they're ruining each other. And so out of a passion to protect the goodness of his world, he washes it clean of humanity's evil with a great flood. But he protects one blameless human, Noah, and his family, and he commissions him as a new Adam. He repeats the divine blessing and commissions him to go out into the world. And so our hopes are really high, but then Noah fails too, and also in a garden. He goes and he plants a vineyard, and he gets drunk out of his mind. And then one of his sons, Ham, does something shameful to his father in the tent. And so here we have our new Adam, naked and ashamed. Just like the first, and the downward spiral begins again. It all leads to the foundation of the city of Babylon. The people of ancient Mesopotamia, they come together around this new technology they have, the brick. And they can make cities and towers bigger and faster than anybody's ever done before. And they want to build a new kind of tower that will reach up to the gods, and they will make a great name for themselves. It's an image of human rebellion and arrogance. It's the garden rebellion now writ large. And so God humbles their pride and scatters them. Now, this is a diverse group of stories, but you can see they're all exploring the same basic point. God keeps giving humans the chance to do the right thing with his world, and humans keep ruining it. These stories are making a claim that we live in a good world that we have turned bad, that we've all chosen to define good and evil for ourselves, and so we all contribute to this world of broken relationships, leading to conflict and violence and ultimately death. But there's hope. God promised that one day a descendant would come, the wounded victor who will defeat evil at its source. And so despite humanity's evil, God is determined to bless and rescue his world. And so the big question, of course, is what is God going to do? And the next story, The Hinge, offers the answer. But for now, that's what Genesis 1 through 11 is all about.
Isn't that good? So what I love is that, okay, there's a lot of questions that you could go into in chapters 1 through 11 in Genesis. But he's like, let's just leave those aside. What is the big picture being presented here? And that wasn't very long. You could have a great discussion about what that is teaching. Is that something we observe in our world? That relationships are broken, that there's all this anger and hatred and oppression. Yeah, so Genesis is actually painting a very clear picture of what our world is like, a very truthful picture of what our world is like. And right there in the beginning, you start to see the beginning of God's rescue plan, and he'll bring that through all of the books of the Bible as he lays them out. So I think, some people are really good at analysis. I tend to like details. Other people are really good at big picture. And this guy is really good at big picture. So I think it would help all of us to understand the Bible better, and certainly could help our kids. You could easily, again, use this kind of material in a small group or even with your kids. I think it's wonderful. So take advantage of those resources. Now, a couple of other videos that I really like are done by Dr. William Lane Craig. And Dr. Craig's videos he has his own YouTube channel called Dr. Craig Videos. And what he has done, he really specializes in the classical arguments for God. So these were developed by Thomas Aquinas and Anselm ages and ages ago, but he's kind of brought them into modern form. And so he talks about the cosmological argument for God, the argument from fine-tuning, the moral argument for God. And he's very quick to say, no one of these arguments for God is the proof that God exists. But they build a cumulative case that believing in God is actually a very rational thing to do based on what we can observe and what we even know through science about our universe. So let me play you a part of this one, not the ontological argument, but the argument from fine-tuning. So you can see he has a lot of different ones. Is there meaning to life? The moral argument, the Leibniz contingency argument. And these are really good little things for you to understand. You can usually memorize one of these arguments in three lines. You know, everything that begins to exist has a cause. The universe began to exist. The universe has a cause. Now, he'll kind of break those out and say, can we argue with those premises? But if the premises are true, then the conclusion is true. And these are just little things that if you learn, then when a teenager says, how do we even know God exists anyway? You can say, well, what does science tell us about our universe? It began to exist. They used to think that it was just eternal. But modern science now tells us that actually it began, time and space, this time-space continuum had a point of coming into existence. Now, how does that happen out of nothing? And so, you know, when you kind of have these arguments that kind of memorized, then you can show that it's rational to believe that if there's a big bang, there must have been a big banger. That's actually very rational to believe. And he really kind of goes through these and explains them more. So let me show you the fine-tuning argument video.
From galaxies and stars, down to atoms and subatomic particles, the very structure of our universe is determined by these numbers. These are the fundamental constants and quantities of the universe. Scientists have come to the shocking realization that each of these numbers has been carefully dialed to an astonishingly precise value, a value that falls within an exceedingly narrow, life-permitting range. If any one of these numbers were altered, by even a hair's breadth, no physical, interactive life of any kind could exist anywhere. There'd be no stars, no life, no planets, no chemistry. Consider gravity, for example. The force of gravity is determined by the gravitational constant. If this constant varied by just 1 in 10 to the 60th parts, none of us would exist. To understand how exceedingly narrow this life-permitting range is, imagine a dial divided into 10 to the 60th increments. To get a handle on how many tiny points on the dial this is, compare it to the number of cells in your body, or the number of seconds that have ticked by since time began. If the gravitational constant had been out of tune by just one of these infinitesimally small increments, the universe would either have expanded and thinned out so rapidly that no stars could form and life couldn't exist, or it would have collapsed back on itself with the same result. No stars, no planets, and no life. Or consider the expansion rate of the universe. This is driven by the cosmological constant. A change in its value by a mere 1 part in 10 to the 120th parts would cause the universe to expand too rapidly or too slowly. In either case, the universe would, again, be life-prohibiting. Or, another example of fine-tuning. If the mass and energy of the early universe were not evenly distributed to an incomprehensible precision of 1 part in 10 to the 10 to the 123rd, the universe would be hostile to life of any kind. The fact is, our universe permits physical, interactive life only because these, and many other numbers, have been independently and exquisitely balanced on a razor's edge. Wherever physicists look,
they see examples of fine-tuning. The remarkable fact is that the values of these numbers seem to have been very finely adjusted to make possible the development of life. If anyone claims not to be surprised by the special features that the universe has, he's hiding his head in the sand. These special features are surprising and unlikely. What is the best explanation for this astounding phenomenon? There are three live options. The fine-tuning of the universe is due to either physical necessity, chance, or design. Which of these options is the most plausible? According to this alternative, the universe must be life-permitting. The precise values of these constants and quantities could not be otherwise. But is this plausible? Is a life-prohibiting universe impossible? Far from it. It's not only possible, it's far more likely than a life-permitting universe. The constants and quantities are not determined by the laws of nature. There's no reason or evidence suggests that fine-tuning is necessary. How about chance? Did we just get really, 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 really lucky? No. The probabilities involved are so ridiculously remote as to put the fine-tuning well beyond the reach of chance. So, in an effort to keep this option alive, some have gone beyond empirical science and opted for a more speculative approach, known as the multiverse. They imagine a universe generator that cranks out such a vast number of universes that odds are life-permitting universes will eventually pop out. However, there's no scientific evidence for the existence of this multiverse. It cannot be detected, observed, measured, or proved. And the universe generator itself would require an enormous amount of fine-tuning. Furthermore, small patches of order are far more probable than big ones. So the most probable observable universe would be a small one inhabited by a single, simple observer. But what we actually observe is the very thing that we should least expect, a vast, spectacularly complex, highly ordered universe inhabited by billions of other observers. So even if the multiverse existed, which is a moot point, it wouldn't do anything to explain the fine-tuning. Given the implausibility of physical necessity or chance, the best explanation for why the universe is fine-tuned for life may very well be it was designed that way. A common sense interpretation of the facts suggests that a super intellect monkeyed with physics and that there are no blind forces worth speaking about in nature. The numbers one calculates from the facts seem to me so overwhelming as to put this conclusion almost beyond question. There is, for me, powerful evidence that there is something going on behind it all. It seems as though somebody has fine-tuned nature's numbers to make the universe. The impression of design is overwhelming. The heavens declare the glory of God. The skies proclaim the work of his hands. Day after day they pour forth speech. Night after night they reveal knowledge.
So again, these are really well done, very professionally done. They explain these complex arguments in a way with the visuals that now I think you probably know the fine-tuning argument. So that's really great. And again, these are kind of cumulative things. Now, in your notes there under God's existence, William Lane Craig also has a book called On Guard. It's a study book designed for using in adult groups where they go through these arguments. There's discussion questions. There's also a student version of that. So it's great for maybe high schoolers to go through that. It's called A Thinker's Guide to the Christian Life. Also, another book that I could recommend is this book, Unbelievable, Why After 10 Years of Talking to Atheists, I'm Still a Christian. That's written by Justin Brierley. If you go down to where it says more online resources, you see this show, Unbelievable. It's a podcast. Justin is a great believer in London. He's been doing this podcast now since 2006 or 2007. And it's a weekly show where he brings together someone who's not a Christian, usually an atheist, and someone who is a Christian, who's well-regarded, who's a thinker. He has William Lane Craig and all these great thinkers on, and they actually have a very civil discussion. It's usually civil. Every once in a while it's not, but it's usually a really good discussion about a particular topic. So this is a great resource. Now, he kind of says, hey, I've been talking to atheists now for 10 years. Here's why I still am a Christian. But what's great about this show is that all the archives are online, and so if there's one particular question maybe a kid has asked you, like, I don't know anything about that, you can go. Podcasts are a wonderful way to beef up your own knowledge because you can listen while you're doing the laundry. I had one on this morning while I was doing some laundry. You can listen in the car on your commute. These are great resources for you. So, and I love The Unbelievable because it gives you an opportunity to hear how does a non-Christian present their side of the argument? What's the case they're making? And then you listen to somebody who's really knowledgeable answer and respond and make their own case. So it's very instructive. So that's on questions of God's existence. The question about science and evolution, of course, that's huge. It's probably one of the biggest things that drive kids from faith is that they're told that evolution, there's absolutely no doubts about evolution, and therefore there's no room for God in that equation, and science has showed it, and so forth. And there are a number of tacks that Christians have made with regard to this problem of science and evolution. One is to just say, well, science is all bad, all wrong, you shouldn't even be doing science. You do find that in some very fundamentalist Christian circles where they basically you should never go into science, it's bad. But science is not bad. In fact, science was born from Christians who believed that because God made the world and made it in an orderly way, it was something that we could learn about and discover because it's ordered by God. And so science actually came out of a Christian framework. It's just been in the last 170 years that it's really kind of become something that's anti-Christian. Now, on the question, one of the things that I do think it's really important to talk to kids, even from the time they're really little, about science. Science is wonderful. I hated science when I was a kid. I love it now. I listen to science podcasts. I just think it's amazing now. I didn't particularly like it when I was a kid. So I'm not a scientist, but I do find it interesting. But one thing that it's important to know about science is that science is always changing, right? Even the way evolution was taught to me when I was a kid in the mid-1970s, it's taught very differently to kids today because science is always changing, and they say, you know, that theory, that way we taught that, that's actually not right. And now they have a different way of explaining it. And this was a very interesting article that came out in 2013. It was a guy at Stanford, John Ioannidis, professor of medicine, and he after doing some research, he basically came up with the fact that, I don't have the statistics in this particular article, but it was some high amount of science that eventually gets overturned, especially in things like medicine. And we've all experienced that where they say, "You don't eat peanut butter, it's cancerous," or what, "Oh no, peanut butter's fine." "Don't eat eggs." "No, now eat eggs." So we see that all the time. And when you get to forms of science like psychology, the chances that a study in psychology can be repeated with the same results is very slim. So you get these headlines, like I don't know if you remember the one recently where it said that religious children are less empathetic than non-religious children. It was some study that was done in England, big headline splash, you know. The problem with those kinds of studies, number one, even when people actually start looking at how they did the study, they find flaws in how it's done. And then most of these studies are not repeat. If you did the same exact study again, you would not come out with the same results. So you ask the question, well, why don't they just repeat every study? It's all about money. Follow the money, because companies and research journals don't want to fund somebody repeating a study. They want a new study, something exciting, something that's going to make a headline, right? So it's sort of the publish or perish idea. So scientists are driven by money as well. It's important that they come up with new things that are even scandalous, you know? Like they'll introduce a new missing link. You know, have you ever seen one of these articles where there's a new missing, we found the missing link from humans to our ape ancestor? What you don't know, because that's a big headline, is that months later when everybody starts digging in and looking, they've decided maybe it's not. That doesn't make the headline. The big find makes the headline. The correction to the find is in all the little is in the scientific journals, but it's not going to make big headline news. So I think it's really important to know science is wonderful. It has allowed us to do amazing things, but it's not infallible. It's not an infallible source of truth. And the whole idea that I was talking to a young boy recently. He told me he was an atheist, about 13 years old. And I said, really? I said, well, you know, how do you think we discover truth? And he said, oh, science. Science tells us everything we know, need to know about what's true. And I said, really, what scientific experiment was done that allowed you to come to that conclusion? He said, what do you mean? Well, you're making a statement that science is what is the only thing that can tell us what's true. Therefore, there must have been some kind of scientific experiment that was done, and the conclusions of that experiment were this, that only science. Well, there was not like a lab or anything. What I was trying to, and I talked to him for quite a long time to show, you are making a philosophical commitment. Science is neutral. It's the interpretation of science that leads to philosophical commitments about our world, whether it's all natural, whether there's God or whatever. It's what we bring to science. Science gives us data, it gives us information, but we bring philosophy to that. And I was trying to show him that actually you're using philosophy to decide that science is how you're going to determine truth. So it actually is one of these commitments that kind of dissolves itself when you kind of get into it. So I think knowing that science is not infallible, and also to make a commitment that only science can tell us what's true, is a philosophical position that you would need to somehow support, not through science. Now, regarding evolution, I just want to make you aware of some of the options that are out there. So with this question of evolution, young earth creationism is the position that the Bible in the first first chapter of Genesis, in the first book of the Bible, is telling us that God created in 7 days, and those are literal days. 24-hour days, 7 days. And usually people who believe this believe that God actually created the earth old. They'll go to a story like when Jesus turned water into wine. And they say, if you would have tested that wine, you would have said it has aged at least 60 days. But the reality is that wine had just been created, but it was created old. And so God did. So there is age to the earth, but it's not real age. God created it old. Yes. Well, so the Ken Ham group is definitely, he is a 7-day, 24-hour creationist.
That part, but not the
That's right. So that's right, because some people also say that the way we date the Earth is incorrect, that we use this thing called carbon. We don't really know about carbon age, you know, so they do dispute some of the science that's involved with how we age things. Right. But so I've heard that position as well. But the bottom line is they're saying that the Bible is teaching it's 24 hours, and that's what we need to believe if we're going to believe the Bible. And they try to do science that supports that. There's also people known as old earth creationists. So they do believe that God directly created, but they do accept the age of the earth, that it's, what's the, is it 64 billion? I don't know what the years are. Anyway, the universe is 64 billion and the earth is whatever billion. So that would be somebody like Hugh Ross at Reasons to Believe, reasons.org. Again, they are all scientists. He's got a chemical biologist on his team. He's a PhD cosmologist. So these are all scientists that are also very committed Christians. And so I think it's good that our kids know there are numbers between 1 and 10 on these issues, that you can be a committed Christian and have a disagreement about the first chapter of Genesis. Theistic evolution is promoted by Francis Collins. He was the director of the Human Genome Project. He very much believes in evolution, but he believes that God was somehow involved in that as a creator. In other words, he either front-loaded life with its potential. So people who believe in theistic evolution look at verses in Genesis 1 where it says, let the earth bring forth plants of every, let the earth bring forth. And so they see that that's compatible with this idea that maybe God front-loaded life with this capacity to develop via evolution the way it does. So that's the biologist.org, Francis Collins. He's written a book called The Fingerprint of God, I think it's called. And he became a believer after he was an adult scientist, and it was through encountering a woman who was dying in a hospital that he actually became a Christian. So he does not see any incompatibility between being a Christian and actually believing in evolution. And then you also have a movement called intelligent design. And intelligent design is not all Christians. Some of the people in that movement are actually very agnostic. One guy is actually a Mooney. He's actually really smart, but anyway. So they're not all Christians, but a lot of them are. And Stephen Meyer is probably the most well-known name. And what their point is that through science, you can detect design. So it would be like saying, if you see the clouds suddenly form a message. Or in that scene, did everybody see that movie Contact? Did you all see that movie? Where I think it's Jodie Foster is the scientist, and she's getting prime numbers that she's getting from outer space. And she goes, now that can't be random. That has to be intelligence, because there's no way that you could line up all the prime numbers just by chance. That even a scientist recognizes when there's intelligence. And so what Stephen Meyer and these other intelligent design people are going through science, now that we're seeing that DNA has all this coding, and we know from our experience that whenever there's things like coding and information and new information, that can only come about through intelligence. So that's kind of, they take a scientific approach. They don't specify what the intelligence is, but they lay a framework for saying, if you want to call that intelligence God, that there is a foundation for that within science itself. So they are not big on evolution. And it's interesting what's going on with evolution even. One of these unbelievable episodes, a couple of scientists went to Royal Society of Scientists in England. They had a big meeting last November. And there were a lot of secular scientists in the fields of biology that are calling for a new theory. that there's the more they understand about DNA and RNA and all these things and the way a cell works, and that they're saying, we actually need a new theory. We've gone as far as we can with Darwin's theory. It's now failing us, and we need a new one. And of course, that was a very alarming thing to say, because people immediately said, are you trying to bring God back into science? And they're like, no, we need another theory. Well, I'm not talking about God. It's very interesting. They're very worried that God might come back in. But it's within the scientific community, it's understood that there are some problems with Darwinianism. And I love these podcasts because they talk about what those scientists are talking about, these secular scientists, that you're just not going to get in a high school biology book. It's kind of presented like, this is a done deal, there's no issues here. Pay no attention to the man behind the curtain. So what I love that all of these different groups are going to bring out different aspects, and it gives options for you, even you, to hang on to faith despite what science is telling you. So I think these are good to know. Let's see, just to finish up a few of these other resources. One thing, let me show you this since we have time. That discovery that Intelligent Design Group do, and they're very connected with Biola University, by the way. They, through a group called Illustra Media, have done these really beautiful videos talking about different aspects of intelligent design. So they might focus on the butterfly. And they really, what they're pointing out in the study of the butterfly and seeing how it goes from a caterpillar to a butterfly and the death that goes on, how these systems that work for a creature, you have to have the whole thing in place for it actually to work. So the whole Darwinian theory that it's random, tiny little random changes that can build a system actually doesn't hold up to scrutiny. So this is a promo for just one of their movies. They're very well done on flight.
Here's the bottom line. You look at the anatomy of a bird, its behavior, its metabolism, the structure of its feathers, the structure of its muscles, and so forth. These are multiple independent points in a complex space out of which flight emerges. And I think from a biological standpoint, to fly at all requires a cause that's able to visualize a distant functional endpoint and bring together everything necessary to achieve that endpoint. Uniquely and universally in our experience, only intelligence is capable of that kind of causal process.
An engineered system is the product of a mind that anticipated a problem and figured out a multi-step way of addressing that problem. In birds, you see exactly that kind of process. They're engineering marvels. They're works of art. We know where engineered things come from. We know where works of art come from. So why would we attribute a bird to anything other than intelligence or mind?
It's not like that on the DVD. It's very good. So what I love about Illustra Media, too, is we're going to do an adult study over 4 nights. We're going to show these videos on Wednesday nights. And I wrote them and said, you know, what do you charge? You know what? And they're like, absolutely use them. There's no charge. You can show them to as many people as you want, big groups or whatever. So they really are interested in getting this information out there. And I don't know who does their photography, but it's amazing. But again, that's all part of the whole intelligent design theory, that you cannot, through random events, get these systems together. That is really believing in a miracle at every step of the way. So my last just heads up here on sexuality. Of course, that's a huge issue right now for our kids. They're being told things about sexuality that are very different what the Bible teaches. So here's a couple of good books. A good book that I would recommend, and also Timothy Tennant, who's the president of Asbury Theological Seminary, did a whole series of lectures on a theology of the body that I thought was wonderful, and you can access that. The question of pluralism or the other religions, that's kind of my specialty, but here's also some other books, and I did do a lecture on pluralism here at Mount Hermon in February. You can get that from the bookstore. They can put that, if you're going to get any of the other things on your little flash drive, they can put that on there for you. Other really great resources, podcasts that I like to listen to. And then one other option for if you've got kids is doing some kind of a gap year for them. If they're a solid Christian kid, they really want to grow in their faith, there's some really good opportunity for them to go and do a gap year where they can really be with kids their age, with some great teachers, and really get solid before they go off to school. So there's some resources for you. So unfortunately, we are out of time already, but hopefully it was helpful. Please pick up some resources. Figure out what you like. Maybe science isn't your thing, but maybe something else. And you know, ratchet up your own critical thinking so that we can help our kids through a much tougher world to retain faith than the one we grew up in. And we definitely want to do that. So God bless.
Thank you.
Yeah.